Welcome to Soul Path Parenting, the podcast that explores how we set our kids up to live their best lives from the start, and how we stay conscious, inspired, and sane while we do it. I'm your host, Amy Breeze Cooper. Hello, and thank you for joining us for episode 3. Today's guest is very near and dear to my heart, Erin Breeze. Does that name sound familiar? She's not just the leader of a transformational program helping divorced moms really turn their experience into a breakthrough for themselves and their kids, but she also is my sister. She's been my thought partner in developing this podcast, and she's going to be an occasional co-host. So I wanted to introduce her and her message on an early episode so that you can get to know her. So divorce, it's pretty widely known that about half of marriages in the U.S. will end in divorce. I was curious how this impacts kids, and logically, about half of American children will experience the breakup of their parents' marriage. What I didn't know that kind of surprised me is that of those kids, half again will experience the breakup of a second marriage. So as we think about how to set our kids up for their best lives, it seems like really looking at the conventions around divorce being a quote-unquote failure and flipping those conventions on their head is so important. And that's what Erin's doing. She actually believes that divorce is a divine disruption. I'll let her explain more about what she means by that, and also the advantages, the divorce advantages that she sees that can come out of a divorce situation. Spoiler alert, for those of you who aren't divorced, they can also be advantages that you can embrace if you're conscious and aware of what they are. So with that set up, let's drop right into the interview with Erin, sharing background on herself and the program that she's created.
I'm so thrilled to be here talking about happy home life after divorce. And of course, it is, you know, this emergence, this community, and this conversation is so deeply personal because our parents divorced when we were young. I was 13, I think, when the decision was officially made. And then a few years ago, I found myself facing divorce. And then I also found that I had this toolkit, this sort of all of these, this expertise and strategies and approaches from over 20 years in the fields of conflict transformation and culture building and change management. And I was looking around seeing so many women, so many fellow moms really struggling and feeling such disappointment and such guilt and such, in some cases, shame, and just really feeling like the future now for them was bleak, that there was this narrative that if when divorce happens, mm-hmm. it's the worst thing that can happen for kids, and that for women especially, everything next is just going to be more struggle, financial struggle, you know, struggle to find love again, struggle to be a single parent, all of it, struggle. And was finding that I had a different outlook on it from all of my background and also a different way of approaching and navigating. And so that's really what I'm thrilled about now is literally equipping, in the program that I run, equipping moms with these same skills and strategies that helped me, but also being part of a shifting conversation about how we talk about divorce, what the divorce experience is, because I really believe everything is about story, and the stories that we're telling ourselves about what's happening in our lives makes all the difference in our actual lived experience. So if we're telling ourselves that it's a really doomsday story, that's what we're going to experience. But if we have an alternative view, then things can be very, very bright. So my whole mission is, how do we have a different conversation about divorce and really invite all of us, married or not, into this conversation, because it affects all of us. I mean, we have such a high divorce rate that it's rare to find somebody who doesn't either have
right.
a sibling who's divorced, or themselves having had divorced parents, or who is facing it themselves. So that is what I am up to.
It's so true. And One of the things I love about what you're doing is really flipping some of those old paradigms and those sort of stories that have been embedded, who knows when they began, but embedded in generation after generation about divorce, and flipping those conventions on their head. And one of the things that I heard you talk about that I would love for you to share with our listeners is this idea that divorce is not a failure. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I love talking about this. And I actually joke that I really do love talking about divorce to people when it's happening, almost in this like congratulatory way. And it has nothing, it's not at all ever in a spiteful or mean way, like, aren't you glad to be rid of the other person kind of way. And I bring that up because that's where my answer starts, is that I feel like for women, we're often given two archetypes. We can either feel broken after divorce, we were left or abandoned, or especially if infidelity happened, like we weren't chosen, we weren't special enough, all of that. Or we can turn and become this spiteful, vengeful, like, I'll show him, I'll live my best life out of revenge kind of option. And it's so, such a bummer. It's so limiting. Neither of those keep the focus on where the focus really should be, which is how do I turn this into the opportunity of my lifetime. And so when I start the conversation with women, it does start there, because they do, with this question of failure, because everybody tells you that you failed, because our convention is that marriage should always last. We have this assumption, this expectation that to be successful in marriage, it should go on. It should have longevity, regardless of whether the partners are both happy or feeling healthy or feeling, you know, actualized or fulfilled or any of that. It's all about longevity in a way, in terms of our norms.
The measuring stick isn't whether you were happy, but how many years of marriage were there?
And I absolutely want to honor and applaud longevity and happy marriages. That is so exciting for me when I see people and can talk to them about what's working and how they do that, including you. And that is, you know, that's of course the ideal, the aspiration. But to measure a human relationship as pass or fail is just completely, like, to me, it's not even an appropriate lens through which to look at something. And that to me, if marriage ends, it's because it was intended to end, and that marriage lasts the length that it lasts. And if we can embrace the learning, the growth, and really see that it's not about pass fail, it's about how am I living. And if it's happened, if divorce is here for us, something wasn't working for one or both partners, right? And so if the last thing we want to do is stay in something that's really limiting us, because we all know if it's limiting us, then we're limited, and then our kids are experiencing that. So I absolutely start with this conversation around divorce not being a failure, and then we go from there.
Another thing that I've heard you talk about is that divorce can be a divine disruption, which feels similar to what you were already mentioning. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, and it definitely builds on this sense that if it's here, it's happening for us. I'm a big believer in that if we choose to look at life as happening for us, not to us, it changes everything. Everything then is here to help us grow, even the pain and the struggle. And I think one of the other norms that we have to really wrestle with and explore and really transform is this idea that a happy life is free of struggle. When we all know that the struggle is, we point in our own lives usually to the very things that were the most painful or the biggest struggle as the thing that helped us to grow the most. So why we then, you know, have certain struggles that are desirable and others we shouldn't ever have, you know, is really, I think, is where people end up feeling like they failed, or like, because they can have any kind of struggle, but you shouldn't have the divorce struggle, right? But if we can shift that and really look at it, well, if it's here, how is it here for me? It really has the opportunity to be an awakening. And that's why I call it a divine disruption, because the divorce disruption, I mean, let's be honest, it is huge. It affects every part of your life. So there's nothing, like, it has the most potential to be an awakening than anything I've certainly experienced. And when I, and then talking to others who've been through it, it's, it goes to the core of so much of who you are and what you thought your future would have in store, all of these huge, huge personal just concepts and issues and beliefs. So yes, if we can look at it as it's this disruption so big and it's here for me, and then how do I leverage it? How do I, you know, really step into it? It is this opportunity to awaken.
So one of the things that occurs to me is that we might have listeners out there thinking, okay, I can handle the struggle, but I just don't want this for my kids. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know that you specifically work with moms going through divorce. So what would you say to those moms that are just really feeling that gut-wrenching sense of like, my kids are struggling?
Right. And And often that's when I meet women that I work with, they're in that place. There's that fear that they will now live a less than life is very common. That now this has happened, and now forever moving forward, my children's lives are less than. And so starting there is really important because that is the big fear, right? And once we start to unpack it, though, and look at what do we really want for our children, and what do they need to see from us in order to live their most fulfilled life, usually once we get into that conversation, we want things like resilience and how to deal with adversity and how to live authentically and how to face things in life that we didn't see coming or we didn't want to have happen. And how do we do things compassionately, even when we are upset with people or are disappointed in some, you know, an action somebody has said? All of these things that are in part, that are absolutely a part of the divorce journey, are the very things that we do want our children to have experienced, right? So if we can make that shift and give ourselves permission to see divorce in the whole context, right, of how do I, for myself and my kids, see this as part of, if it's happening for me, it's happening for them too. And I know that can be a stretch at first, but once we start to look at what kind of life were you living prior to the divorce? If you've ended up divorced, you weren't happy, or you weren't living your fullest potential, or you were dimmed or even harmed or silenced in your marriage. You wouldn't be divorced if there wasn't something that was a dysfunction. And so if we can focus on all the opportunity of moving your kids out of that and into what's next, then we can really start to dream about that and get excited about that and start to create that. And that's, of course, why the work is called Happy Home, is that that's ultimately where we're wanting to get, right? Is a new family culture that has the parents, and of course I'm working with the moms, but believe for both, the moms and the dads, that has them healthy and fulfilled and thriving because they are the heart of their home. And we want our children to, they can only kind of, in my view, receive our fullest heartbeat if we are in alignment and feeling the full vitality and feeling hopeful and all of those things. So we really, it doesn't serve us to wish for a relationship that wasn't allowing us to live that way.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it means for our kids to live their best lives? So more specifically, what do you hope for your girls?
Yeah, I think about it daily, right? I think there's nothing, for me, there's nothing like having two human beings to guide, to keep that question, like, what does that even mean? And how do I do that? And my girls are 11 and 6. So they're also at very different developmental stages now in their own awareness of self and ideas about the world. And so for me, it's really like, where do they, helping them discover who they are, which is like, where do they find joy? Where do they seem to lose themselves in their own imagination and their own just world where they're really creative and inventive and feeling lit up, right? So it's as a parent, like looking to see. And then also I feel like to live the best life, like we have to encounter all kinds of things that aren't idyllic, right? Like that are hard, that are people aren't nice to us, or we have a hard time in a certain class if we're struggling in academics or whatever it is. Like we have in this external world, we have to navigate. So I feel like we want to really get in touch with what lights them up and who this being is so that we can create opportunities for them to just be. At the same time, they each need a very different toolkit to equip them to hold space for themselves as they navigate a world that can be, depending on their personality, their preferences, who they are, like more or less difficult, right? And so then it's like, as a parent, I feel like we're constantly, okay, what does my child need to be successful? And how do I make sure that it's following their guideposts of what success looks like, right? And for me, that's like them feeling confident to be who they are, that they're valued at home and at school, that people see them and really that they belong mm-hmm. in these places and spaces.
We talked about kids' best lives, and I'm curious what you feel like it means for parents to live their best lives, especially in the context of single motherhood, which, of course, we have a societal story about that, too, and it's not a very pretty picture. So how are you repainting that picture?
I actually see it differently, that there are some really beautiful advantages. I call them divorce advantages that actually I think are helpful for both married and non-married people, but for women in particular. So to this question of the best life, like when divorce happens, you have no choice but to do an inventory of your whole life. You are required to in ways. You're moving homes. Somebody's moving a home. So you're dealing with things and an inventory of stuff. And you have all the legal stuff if you had a legal marriage and like all of the stuff that you really have to do this inventory. I see this as an advantage because I hear so often women saying, I've lost myself in motherhood. I've lost myself in my marriage. I'm told to put my kids first, and we still are, even in the most equitable households, more often we see the woman, especially when kids are small, putting her career on the back burner or choosing a professional track that's going to give the family more flexibility so that that her partner can stay, do as much full time and all of those things. So the divorce advantage then that I see and invite women who are married to just for themselves think about, because you don't have to wait to be awakened in this way, but is to really ask those questions of like, who am I and what do I want? Because often we talk about, or we hear like the empty nest syndrome or this kind of, you know, your kids leave and then people go through that process. We don't have to wait. So the advantage with divorce is that it's come to you much sooner maybe. But what's beautiful is I feel like it's part of this really urgent conversation for women to have of like, it is not doing anybody service for us to not be fully expressed, fully in pursuit of our purpose. Like, and this is where I kind of sometimes get planetary with feeling like never more important than now to have women actively involved in everything. So what I don't want to see is that if we've been told that we have to sacrifice everything for partner and children, right, then we're like the whole world is missing from the insight, the creativity, the innovation that women bring. So one of my favorite divorce advantages is that very awakening to who was I before all of this, marriage and relationship and children, and what do I have to bring? What is my big purpose, my big why, and how do I get on with it now? And really using divorce as this opportunity to get really clear and committed around that.
I love it. And it's so funny because when mom heard the first episode, she said, you know, you say I love it a lot. So I'm reserving it now. But I really did love that. So thank you for sharing that. And one of the things you just mentioned is about people finding their purpose and getting on with it. And I know you heard last week's conversation with Willow, and she had some really great perspective on that. I'm just wondering how you coach people to think about purpose, because it can feel really big and unwieldy and like you're supposed to find something out there that's, it can just feel daunting, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm curious your perspective.
Yeah, to me, it's not, you're right. I also feel like we have this sense that it has to be global to be a purpose, right? It has to be so big. When to me, it's not like physical scale, it's like depth of meaning. So if your deep meaning has to do with something that you're creating in alone in your home, right? It doesn't need to be out there in the world. Only you know it because it's a whispering, a voice. It's something you've heard, I believe, for most of like. And I get that some people maybe feel like they've never heard a whisper, and so I think sometimes that's because they have heard it, but they've been told that or they believe that wouldn't be the right thing because it doesn't mm-hmm. fit some view of what purpose should be. So I have no judgment on the purpose itself. It comes from that inner guidance, that inner knowing that mm-hmm. I am aligned with where I can contribute my gifts and be in a place that appreciates and values my gifts. It's like a combination of I'm doing what I'm here to do, and I'm expressing it, and I'm finding the way to be offering it, sharing it, making it available, right? That's how I would answer that.
I love that you said that it can come as a whisper, because I also feel like a lot of times it's there, and yet we're so busy and we're moving so fast that we're not present to and tuned in enough to hear it. Mm-hmm. So I actually think for some people, their purpose could even be to be present and slow down. And then maybe there's something right. more to do. But oftentimes the doing, from everything I've learned, is to actually sort of give up the doing and embrace the being. And until you do that, for many people, you won't hear it because it is a whisper.
Right.
I hope you guys could hear that. But you won't hear it because it really legitimately is mm-hmm. a whisper, and we're all just so distracted and going a million miles an hour and can't really hear it.
Well, and we've also, many of us as kids, had an interest or an inclination that we got a lot of negative feedback on too. So it could also be very buried because it might not fit the standard for yeah. what our family had in mind or our society had in mind. So there's a lot, it can be, there's many, many layers to why we might feel we don't know what it is that can be
so
explored.
Let's talk about that. Did you get any of that growing up? I have like a clear idea about that for myself that I want to share, which is I recently realized that I loved art, and I'm now seeing Isla, my 4-year-old, she loves art, and she's creating all these pictures that objectively I'm like, those are really good. And then I'm worried about evaluating and judging, right? Because it was actually the judgment of then later years, I took AP art and I scored a 3 out of 5. So obviously I'm not an artist. Obviously I'm not destined to go down that path. And I remember there was someone else in my class that got the same score that was literally going to art school. I don't remember if it was Rhode Island School of Design or Savannah, but one of those really well-known art schools. And I just thought, well, but you got a 3. So I was so tied up in the judgment and the fact that, well, I wasn't good enough, that I just, between that and of course our parents who were like super academically focused, like, you're not going to art. Like, that never would have been even a conversation we would have had at home. I just shut that part of me down. And it's almost like a whole creative part of me got cut off for a long time. I'm just curious if you had that experience at all.
Well, I love that share, and it does make me think of, because we were talking earlier about like ways to support our kids to be their best selves. And one of the things that we can ask our kids when they're doing, creating, doing anything is, how do you feel when you're doing that? Helping them connect to, it's not the end result. It's when I feel joyful or I feel excited or I feel creative or all of these things that we can place value on, because we did. We grew up in a household that was very, what's the report card say? What are the results? What's the final grade? Rather than, did this bring you joy? And is this something that you're interested in? Like, pursuing
right.
something because you're passionate about it. Like, imagine that would have been a very different conversation.
Right. I feel like that's the whole new realm of parenting that we're starting to uncover. And it also goes back to the being versus the doing, right? That, like, in these moments of creativity, I suppose that is a doing if you're coloring with markers like we do around here, painting or whatever, but there's almost this presence about it that it's more about sort of being in the moment that it allows. And like you said, the joy. And so I've really been trying to work at flipping the conversation, because already my 4-year-old is pretty attached to praise. I've probably been giving her an IV drip of that since birth. So nobody's perfect. But yeah, it's maybe we can cultivate a new conversation and you know.
Yeah, and in the same way with things that we struggle with. We grew up, if something wasn't easy enough for us, then it meant that we were bad at it, right? Or it wasn't, if there was, at least I grew up feeling like the things that were hard for me in math or science, I'm just to move away as quickly as I could. There wasn't, that I must just not be gifted in that, right? And so I need to, rather than embracing and like having, being supported that you might get a C, but if you work really hard because this isn't easy for you, we're rewarding and celebrating the fact that it's not easy for you and still you're pursuing it and like valuing the fact that struggle and difficulty, like there are all, for all of us, things that are just harder. But if we can not have that inevitably be like some kind of reflection on a limit or a weakness, instead it's like, oh, that's just one of your things that is going to be harder for you, and then applaud whatever you do because you're working hard at it and really trying and really, you know, dedicated, would also really shift, I think, how honest our kids are about their interests, their likes, how they're doing, if we give them that permission.
Yeah, so that it's about the effort and the experience rather than the result. Mm-hmm. Were you the one that told me that there's, it's kind of a cultural context and there's places where math, people are really good at math? Can you talk about that?
I was just thinking about that. And here's one of my reveals.
If you can remember.
I'm the person who remembers like two parts, not the, any of the specifics. I can't ever remember who it was exactly. But it was, yes, it was a math lesson. Well, maybe in the notes we can do some research on it. But it was really like saying that one of the reasons that Americans struggle in our math performance overall is this, that we don't have like the muscle for difficulty because we don't encourage kids to go past that and sit in that struggle and reward them if it took 2 hours. Celebrate that, wow, it was really hard for you. Whereas places that have real math proficiency are building that in so that kids don't immediately opt out. They keep going. So like our muscle for going, keep, you know, sticking with things is really underdeveloped. So we need to do that for our kids. But you had asked about thoughts I had reflecting back and growing up of like hints of what I was aspiring to do or might want to do. And it's interesting because my childhood hero is Jane Goodall. You, I'm sure, remember. I was fascinated. Like she, I wanted to be a primatologist. I just was so, and then what I, in looking back, of course, we can sort of see these through lines or these patterns. Like I have always been gravitating toward to learn about behavior. Started with primate behavior, and then it moved to the extremes of human behavior, and really has, like, I was always drawn to kind of new frontiers in our understanding about how people work and how communities interact, and also what's then possible as we learn things. I mean, before Jane's work, like, we had no knowledge of the complexity of chimpanzees. Like, our everything is different because of her patience and her observation and her dedication, right? And so I think the reason I mention it is like, I think sometimes we have this these inclinations when we're little, like they're just like little hints or mystery or little, you know, metaphors even, and we're not going to know. We just have to keep moving toward them, even when they're not going to make sense to anyone else sometimes than us.
Right.
And also we just need life's journey to start to see how they map together.
Right. Yeah. It reminds me of John, my husband, your brother-in-law, but yes, for everybody else, yes, my husband, and his inclination towards theater. And early on, I think in second grade, his school teacher recognized that theater could be a really good fit for his personality traits. And so his mom put him in that, and he did it for years, I think all the way through high school, and did not become an actor. But what he ended up doing was becoming a startup, an entrepreneur, basically a startup guy pitching ideas to people and dreaming big and improvising when stuff goes wrong, because inevitably it does. And it's funny because I look at that and I go, wow, it's like this, the seeds were there. He didn't take the more like obvious route to apply those skills. And it's also so clear that he took that and applied those skills.
And I think now more than ever for our kids, there is no way we can predict the kinds of jobs that will exist. You know, we just, there's no way. So we have to, I think the, in a good way, this makes it so that we have to rely on helping them build their intuition, of what they're drawn to, what their passions are, because they're going to be inventing and creating. The things that they'll be doing just don't exist right now. They're not on our radar. So in a good way, we don't have to assign these labels of some of the jobs and the titles and the things, because those things are all going to be different. So hopefully that'll give them more permission from an earlier age to just chart their own course.
I totally agree. So let's go back a little bit. We talked about the fact that we talked about moms really getting grounded in themselves. And we also talked about the divorce advantage that has to do with being aware of like who you are and not getting lost. And it feels like there's this theme of self-care and really not putting yourself above everybody else, but there is this conversation of like, you know, you've got to have a foundation of yourself feeling whole and healthy in order to provide that foundation for your family. Can you talk a little bit about self-care, maybe both broadly as well as share your personal approach?
Yeah, I would love to. I think in general, moms are not taking care of themselves in the way that they need to. And we still have this idea that like it's selfish in a negative way to take time, when we also know that when we take time and slow down and get our sleep, get some rest, that's the only space for, even on a cellular level, healing. Like our body needs us to take a break so that it literally can heal and grow, like thrive, and not, like we now know, thankfully, have so much more research around this for long-term illnesses and chronic things, like all of it, right? That if we're not letting our bodies rest and recuperate, like we're compromising our own health. So sometimes that can be a really helpful hook to go, look, you have to do this. It's sometimes hard for us to do it for ourselves. Can you just do it if you look 20 years down the road, if you maintain this level of stress or strain, right? Something's going to give. I think it's fortunate. There's so much more happening around that conversation of self-care for us. I think we have so much more permission than our mom certainly did to do that and to value doing that. So I certainly have a daily practice around gratitude and meditation. And I have a weekly practice around exercise. I won't lie and say I do that every day. I'm going to add it into my daily, but it's not. So I think, you know, I talk a lot in the program with the women I work with around like what your recipe is. Like we each have a recipe, and there are certain things that I believe should be on everybody's recipe. And that does include some kind of mindfulness and absolutely includes gratitude. And because in my program, we're doing a lot of reflection, I'm a big believer in journaling in our lives as a tool. It doesn't have to be hours and hours, but when we put things on paper, we can get so much more clarity around what we're doing with our thinking, which is so important for self-care. Because if our thoughts are dosing us with negativity or self-doubt or criticism, then it doesn't matter how much yoga we do, we're giving our body stress, hormones, we're not allowing, we can't receive the self-care we're like signing ourselves up to try to receive, right? If our thinking isn't allowing it, right? So also there's a lot of work around mindset that I think is an important part of everybody's self-care.
That's great. So you talked about the divorce advantage of really awakening now to who you are, rather than putting that out into the empty nest phase or into the future. And I know there are other divorce advantages. You've told me that there's more, at least. And I'm really curious if you have any more to share with us.
I would love to. One of the other divorce advantages, and again, my hope is that this is available now to divorced or not divorced people, to take them as advantages for you too, as you're listening and can apply it in your life. But one that has really impacted me, and I see it in the women that I work with, is getting really intentional. When divorce happens, you're forced to get intentional about certain themes and concepts that we, I think, all too often take for granted when in married life. Things like what family is and means, things like what love looks like and trust, and these concepts that when you're in a family unit, there's sort of a blanket assumption that the kids are seeing a couple and they're picking up either by osmosis or just, you know, however, around like what the this is what family looks like, right? And this is what love looks like. And so when divorce happens, suddenly you have to redefine and get really clear. And what I have loved in my own experience is some of the conversations then that come up that divorce brings you. And one example I can think of that happened not too long ago was Ray, who is now my six-year-old. As we were leaving the soccer field, she turned to me and asked me, "Do you still love Daddy?" And, you know, here we are, 9 o'clock in the morning, leaving the soccer field, lots of people around, like not expecting that question as she's scootering along and I'm lugging one of many bags of things from the field. And of course, it's such an understandable question and such an important question. And it allowed me then to have this conversation with her about what love is and how love between a mom and a dad who are married changes in the sense of not wanting to live together as a couple, but that how parent to child love never changes, and explain more about that. And also how love to him, her dad, will always be there because we're always family, and I'll always have this gratitude for our relationship and the years we share, all of those things, right? And so it made me aware that like the love is such a big word, and we really want to equip our kids with an idea of like, What is it, and how should it feel, and what is unconditional, and what are conditions, and all these kinds of things, right? That for some of us we figure out in our 30s and 40s, right? But that to be able to have and begin these conversations, and have her know how much I love him and his parents and my extended family of hers through him that I had years with, you know, I was married 12 years. So also love and stay connected in this bigger extended family. So I think that I'm grateful for the way then that divorce has brought an intentionality of teaching what family is and feels like, and what trust is and feels like, and friendship and love and these things. And, you know, her follow-up question was did I love his almost wife? He's about to get remarried, and also makes so much sense. And so gave me this opportunity to talk about my, you know, friendship with her future stepmom and my gratitude for her and how she's this wonderful, loving presence in their life and all these other things that I feel grateful to be able to be that intentional now. And because of those conversations, then I think of all these other kinds of conversations that I want to be more intentional about in my own, you know, in my home culture, with my girls.
That's great. You know, I started all of this because Isla asked me what's going to happen to her when she dies. How would you answer that question?
I know. I remember when that happened, and it is such a big question. I, you know, for us now, with having lost Mike, so we lost our stepdad last summer. Mm-hmm. It went from the hypothetical, right, to like very specific, especially for Harper, my oldest, who was actually there with him the morning he died, and so it was her first experience of seeing somebody. Hours, you know, a day before death, and then seeing a body when the person had departed. And so it's such a different conversation now, having had that lived experience. And I think, you know, a few years ago, I was at a different place. I wouldn't have been talking about reincarnation, which is a belief I have. And some of this, I'm more in tune with that personally. And so that is part of how I answer, is that I do believe that our soul moves on, and that we also, what I take great comfort in, and my girls do now that I've shared with them this belief, is that we move in soul groups, so we know we'll come back together at some point. And that what I want them to know is that the death of the body isn't the death of the soul and the spirit, mm-hmm. and that we don't have to fear it. And that one of the things that has become really, really beautiful in our home is we see Grandpa in the things that were his passion. So when the hummingbird comes and feeds, or when we see butterflies, he was such a part of our connection to nature, that we see him in those things and they feel him. And so it also for them feels like evidence of this soul living on, and that we are always connected even after death.
That's beautiful. Yes, now Isla has heard about reincarnation and she wants to know when Grandpa Mike's coming back as a baby.
I know.
Which is a little...
It's a little soon. It's a
tough question.
Tell her she has to wait for a little while. According to my sources, it doesn't happen quite that quickly.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Erin. And I am so looking forward to co-hosting future episodes with you.
I can't wait. Thank you so much for having me.
So as always, I want to leave you with a nugget of inspiration from that interview that you can apply in your own life. And what I want to highlight this week is this really simple idea of getting our kids in touch with what lights them up in a really present way. So if you don't know what your kids love to do and experience joy doing, this is an opportunity to have a conversation. And if you do know, this is an opportunity to really emphasize with them the experience that they're having doing it rather than evaluating how good they are at it. Because this simple awareness as we do this and repeatedly do this as we raise our kids will have them begin to tap into what it means to be present in the joy of doing something versus attached to the outcome of it. And it is those little seeds of inspiration, those things that light them up that will put them on the path to really live their life fulfilling whatever their purpose is. So I just want to encourage you to take a moment this week to tap into that with your kids and tap into that with yourselves and see how it goes. As always, thank you so much for joining us. If you know a mom who's facing divorce or going through divorce that could use a reset and an inspiring message, please pass this episode along. And if you like what you've been hearing, please subscribe so we can share more of this conversation with you. If you're interested in learning more about Erin's program, check out the episode page at soulpathparenting.com. Until next week, I hope you have a wonderful week.